This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The second annual Minority Health Film Festival kicks off in Milwaukee today. Between now and September 24th, 50 films, events, and discussions will highlight how institutions and communities impact the health of marginalized groups. Of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, this festival will be virtual, with the exception of some drive-in events. Dr. Kamara Jones gave the keynote speech for the festival today. Jones is a family physician and epidemiologist whose work focuses on naming, measuring, and addressing the impacts of racism on the health and well-being of people. She spoke with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about people of color bearing the brunt of the COVID-19 virus and how the nation can begin to work towards health equity.
Black and brown and indigenous folks are overrepresented among those who are infected and then overrepresented among those who are dying from COVID-19 is not because we are more susceptible. We are no more susceptible to this virus than anybody else. At the beginning in 2019, December, there was no human on this planet who was immune to this virus. What we are is we're more likely to get infected because we're more exposed and less protected. And then once infected, we're more likely to die because we're more burdened by chronic diseases with less access to health care. Now, each of those things, more exposed, why are we more exposed? Well, first of all, we're more likely to be in those poorly paid frontline jobs, you know, grocery clerks, bus drivers, you know, mail delivery people, warehouse workers, in the meat packing plants, poultry packing plants. And why are we more likely to be in those frontline jobs? It's because when the federal government solidified racially segregated communities in this country, I mean, that's been the case over centuries, but especially in the 20th century, where the VA and the FHA and all of these federal agencies solidified racially segregated communities and then disinvested in those communities. Now you have poor communities, and when the schools are supported by local property tax and you have poorly funded schools, which turns into poor educational outcomes and often, and another generation lost, and then those poorly educated people, what job opportunities do they have? So it's directly out of that line. So that's racism in one thing. Then why are we less protected, right? Well, even though we're essential workers in these jobs, we're not highly valued. We're not valued in our pay. We're not valued in personal protective equipment, not valued with hazard pay or, you know, family and medical leave. You know, so we're less protected in terms of on the job or even being able to stay away from the job when the job is hazardous. Then why are we more burdened by chronic diseases? It has the same thing to do with the disinvestment and crowding into communities where you have environmental hazards, no access or limited access to green space, crowded housing, public transportation, if you can get it, you know, no access to healthy foods or very limited at high price access to healthy foods. All of these things, all of these adverse neighborhood conditions, which are not even provoking action, and very often racism, especially structural racism, shows up as inaction in the face of need. So that's making us sicker. That's giving us more of the diabetes, more of the high blood pressure, more of the kidney disease, the asthma, and all of those things that once you get infected with the virus are going to cause you to have a worse outcome. And then what about the healthcare system? So everything I've said so far has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do with the conditions of our lives. But then even in terms of the healthcare, first of all, especially early on in the pandemic, Black folks were showing up at hospitals to be evaluated and sent home to die without even getting a temperature taken or a COVID-19 test. The testing centers were located in affluent areas, and especially at the beginning, they were drive up. What if you don't have a car? Requiring a doctor's, order. What if you don't have getting access to a primary care doctor. So all of that. And even once you get in the hospital, these criteria that hospitals are drawing up to govern how they're going to deal with the situation if they have one ventilator left and 10 people who need it, these crisis standards of care are baking into the criteria of who is going to get that last ventilator, whether or not you have kidney disease, whether or not you have diabetes, and putting people who have those conditions at lower chance of getting the life-saving equipment that they need, the therapies that they might need. And so that's baking in the structural racism that's already in our bodies, baking it into that how we're going to care for folks.
I like the way you broke down that there are really levels to the disadvantages that are stacked against Black, Indigenous, and other people of color, from the divestment in our communities to the lack of transportation, the jobs that we work, each really continuing to impact our health. And people who don't have a reason to pay attention to these types of issues likely aren't aware of how extensive the problem is.
Many people who don't live in those neighborhoods, never even go through those neighborhoods, don't even understand the conditions in those neighborhoods, and really don't understand that there are people living in those neighborhoods who are just as kind, funny, generous, hardworking, smart as they are, but living in very different circumstances. And there are people in this country who blame folks who are trapped in some of these disinvested neighborhoods, blame them as being lazy or stupid. If they just worked harder, they would be able to get out.
Exactly.
So I just want to share that there are 7 different things that characterize how we look at one another in this country. I am now calling these values targets, that are making the government and many people who are better off or, you know, in power, blind to the conditions that are not only causing folks to be more affected by COVID-19, but God forbid we have COVID-21. If we don't change these conditions or you know, H1N1 24, I mean, we as a world are getting so close to the so-called natural environment, and there are going to be so many more crossovers of animal diseases to humans. And if we do not change the structured inequity in our societies, then every pandemic that comes through, every flood, every hurricane, everything is going to continue to pound on the same people. We need to value all of us equally. We need to recognize and rectify historical injustices, and we need to provide resources according to need. Those are actually 3 principles for achieving health equity that I have distilled.
I'm actually glad you brought up those 3 principles for achieving health equity, because I was going to bring them up. I saw them in an article that you wrote for Newsweek back in April of this year. Summarize what you mean by each of those principles and how we might see them in practice in the healthcare system.
Well, when you value all individuals and populations equally, first of all, you're going to make sure that if you value folks, you're going to have their voice at decision-making tables, right? When you're trying to figure out something that pertains to them. So it means reaching out to communities and all kinds of folks. If you're trying to figure out what are we going to do about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on Black and brown communities, you need to bring Black and brown community voices to those decision-making tables. They could give you a lot of insight about what we need to be doing, right? So often people at decision-making tables think they have all the knowledge and expertise and perspective that they need, and they don't reach out to the communities that are being affected.
Right.
For that second principle, recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, first of all, what it means is that each of us needs to know, first of all, our full U.S. history, and so many of our textbooks don't have our full histories. They might have 1 or 2 paragraphs about, the enslaved Africans and African descendants, you know, and depict them as happy or whatever. Even these days, there is an attempt to say that we cannot teach about or talk about the 401 years now of the presence of Africans brought to this country in chains, enslaved, as very well written in the 1619 Project of the New York Times. There's been pushback by some people to say that we can't look at that. So all we have to know our full history. Then we should each know the history of the neighborhood we're in, the city we're in. And if you are a decision maker, you need to, if you're trying to untie a knot, if you have a thorny problem that you're trying to solve, wouldn't it behoove you, wouldn't it be good for you to know how that knot was tied, to look at the history of how the you know, if you're trying to do something about housing in such and such a neighborhood, well, how did the housing get like that? When did the highway come through? What was up with that? Who was, you know, forcefully removed by eminent domain, and who was not paid or not relocated? You know, so we need to understand history. We need to, first of all, recognize and then rectify historical injustices. And then how do we provide resources according to need? Now, the first thing is to recognize that I didn't say provide resources equally. There's a difference between equality and equity. Equity is when you provide people with what they need.
Dr. Jones, you say your work is really helping people to name, measure, and address racism. And it just made me think about Milwaukee County declaring racism a public health crisis. If you were working with Milwaukee County officials, what would you say to them about how to keep that conversation going and turn it into action? Because, of course, it's not enough to just declare racism this crisis. I mean, it's great to declare that, right? That's the first step. But how do we turn that declaration into action?
So first of all, I have to congratulate Milwaukee County for being the first to make that formal declaration of racism as a public health crisis in May of 2019. So that's more than a year ago. And what would I say to Milwaukee County now? I say you need to make sure that you're not just running things by the community in terms of what you're planning to do or this, but that you are asking the community to help you develop an agenda, that you are in solid partnership with that every committee that you have, every county agency and all, that you have very, very strong mechanisms for sustained community input. So that's the first thing, that this is a partnership, because a declaration is one thing. You're saying, okay, Milwaukee, hold us accountable. We've declared racism to be a public health crisis. We've said the word, now hold us accountable. But to really be accountable, you have to be in partnership with people and you have to be willing to listen. So that's the first thing. That's the valuing all individuals and populations equally. That's how it would be manifest there. You also have to be willing to invest deeply in communities that have been historically disinvested. So you need to actually put more resources in communities. You need to clean up environmental hazards. There should be nobody living in what the Environmental Protection Agency would call a sacrifice zone. That's a real thing. They call some communities sacrifice zones because they are right next to known polluting industries. You should be putting, you should be investing in Black business. So the partner, you know, in terms of who does the work, you need to be investing in Black schools. Now, I know that there's no such thing as a Black school because, you know, it's all public schools or whatever. But there are, because we look at, you know, the racial segregation in our neighborhoods, which turns into racial segregation in our schools. We need to be investing, enriching the poor rocky soil of some communities until it's as rich as the richest fertile soil in other communities in the area, right? And so that's when you're talking about recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. The third thing you have to do is to, and I guess I just said it in terms of recognizing and rectifying, that providing resources according to need. The resources could be early childhood education. The resources could be better public transportation to all parts of everywhere. Of the three principles I gave, when you provide resources according to need, then that is a way of recognizing and rectifying historical injustices. And it in recognizing and rectifying historical injustices, that is a way of valuing all individuals and populations equally. So if I had to pick one of those principles to guide how you go forward, look at the need in the area. Just document the need. I'm sure it's already in all kinds of tables and graphs everywhere. And then provide resources according to need, which might mean that some folks go a year, 2 years, maybe a decade without additional resources until you bring the other folks up. This is not just giving a little bit of something on the top. We're not trying to ice this cake. There's a huge hole in the cake, and we need to fill that up first before we can put some icing on top of it.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Dr. Kamara Jones is an epidemiologist and an expert in the connection between race and health. She was the keynote speaker for Milwaukee Film's Minority Health Film Festival, and she spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell.